receive a $40,000 grant and get the support you need to start or grow your business. The program is open to all residents of Southeast Alaska. Applications are due May 30th by 5 p.m. For more information and to apply, visit us online at www.p2pweb.org. This message is brought to you by the Hawnee Community Development Fund and the Nature Conservancy.
Good afternoon, Juneau. In a couple of seconds, it'll be 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore going to be your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Great lineup of guests today. We're going to be talking very shortly here with Dan Kroll and Dove Gartenberg about the upcoming Sunday fundraiser for NAMI called Comedy for a Cause. Our new series, Fish 101, is going to start today. We'll be talking about the history of DIPAC with Rich Mattson. Zool Bailey will be checking in from Sitka to tell us about the Sitka Summer Music Festival, and we'll learn about Wednesday's Juneau Symphony Youth Solo Competition. All that's coming up this weekend, so stay tuned to hear about that here on Juneau Afternoon. Right now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A tribal chairman in Wisconsin is questioning whether the state is falsely raising concerns that the annual Ojibwe spearfishing season is a threat to public peace. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Chris Magishik heads the Mole Lake Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He spoke to the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board about a proposed rule that could change how the state adjusts the number of walleye and muskie that sport anglers can harvest on northern Wisconsin lakes as Chippewa tribes are doing their spring off-reservation spearfishing. Chairman Magishik criticized the rule and some of the language in state documents, particularly a sentence that said the rule was needed to promote the preservation and protection of public peace in areas yielded long ago by federal treaties.
We have sport anglers out there harvesting right alongside tribal members out there spearing. What type of user conflict has been associated with that? I've heard none.
Magishik says the off-reservation spearfishing has been going on about 3 decades, and the first few years were controversial, but he says there's less tension now. He also says the tribes have not had a chance for input on the state rule. Wisconsin Natural Resources Department leader Kathy Stepp says the rule just tries to add more certainty to adjusting fish harvest limits.
I have been hearing for years, since the day I walked in the door at this job, of the impact of the roller coaster effect and the unpredictability and instability of swinging bag limits. What that does to tourism in the northern third of the state, and it is devastating.
The Wisconsin Natural Resources Board passed the fish limit rule, but state lawmakers can review the action. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
The Nota Begay Foundation, or NB3, and the Jewish Community Center of Greater Albuquerque are teaming up to host the first star-studded Rio Grande Charity Slam. NB3 Director of Community Relations, Clint Begay, says golf is a growing sport in Indian country. He says the game gets a little expensive and courses tend to be in cities, but he says there are many positives.
Golf is a game that teaches you a lot, not only about golf, but it teaches a lot about life. Golf allowed me to get an education in college, and it allowed me to do a caddy for a living for 10 years, so it provided me a profession for 10 years. And that's the mission that we have with our junior golf program, is try to allow kids the opportunity, because it's done so much for our family. And so we're just trying to give back to see these kids grow in a game that is not too popular. You know, basketball and baseball and football will always reign supreme on the reservations, but sports like golf and soccer, you know, they're coming up, and we'll continue to try to, you know, influence kids to try these sports.
The Charity Slam will feature Native American athletes like NB3 founder Nota Begay and Dallas Cowboys cheerleader Veronica Ann Lind. Proceeds will benefit the NB3 Foundation and the Jewish Community Center. Other professional players from golf, basketball, and football are expected to participate in June at Santa Ana Pueblo's Resort and Golf Course in New Mexico. The Cherokee Nation Tribal Council voted this week to make changes in the tribe's transparency laws. The council approved amendments to the Freedom of Information Act and Government Records Act. The changes include adding a staff member to research and respond to citizen information requests and adding protections for personal information of tribal members, such as social security numbers. The measure still requires a vote at the Tribal Council meeting in June and the signature of the principal chief to become law. During this month in 1993, the Alaska Native Justice Center was established. The center was created to serve the unmet needs of Alaska Native people in the civil and criminal justice systems. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next two guests are here to tell us about an upcoming fundraiser for a really good cause. This is Comedy for a Cause. It's a musical comedy review. Don Kroll is in town to perform in this. Rob Cohen will be playing the piano. Dove Gartenberg is here to tell us all about that sort of stuff. And so tell us, A, why you're doing this.
Sure. Well, NAMI Juneau is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We're a nonprofit organization that provides support, education, and advocacy for those living with mental illness, individuals and families. And we're very active here in Juneau for many, many years, although this is the first time in many a moon that we've had a fundraiser. And we're very excited about this fundraiser to help train volunteers to be peer teachers and facilitators for our support groups and our educational programs. And the main idea, though, is it's Comedy for a Cause, so it's going to be a very, very funny afternoon on Sunday, and we brought the star to be here all the way from Dallas.
Dallas, Texas.
So, Don, we've arranged a pianist in the next studio, and we're ready to start.
That's fine with me. Fine with me.
Give us an idea of what you do. It says on your poster that you do musical comedy with a pianist. So is this...
So Rob Cohn,
yeah,
from Juneau, is my accompanist, absolutely splendid, splendid accompanist. And it's interesting, Dove said, so from what musicals are you singing? And I said, well, it's very difficult these days to find a musical comedy song that can stand alone from a musical comedy. Yeah. But I have appeared on Broadway. I am an actor, and all of my life I have always enjoyed musical theater and have toured in companies of Man of La Mancha. But to pull out a funny song from Man of La Mancha would be impossible. So I found a song from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum by Stephen Sondheim called I'm Calm, which is a fun song, and I think you can just pull it out and sing it. Doubled Over Laughing, I'm Not Sure. Smiling and getting a kick out of the lyrics, which is what you have to listen to, great.
Mm-hmm.
And my other source was Danny Kaye, who was, to some of us, the best all-around song and dance comedian, actor. He could do it all.
Mm-hmm.
And
fabulous dancer.
Yes. Yeah. And with songs written by his wife, Sylvia Fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to listen to the lyrics. There's no four-letter words. There's no toilet humor. It's all very, very clever writing. She wrote, I'll never forget the morning.
And rhymes that will knock you for
yes.
a loop.
Yes.
Amazing words to stick into a song and rhyme with.
I'll never forget the morning that Grandpa ate the awning to impress a pretty lady who went for men that were shady.
Uh-huh.
So the puns, but you have to listen closely because it goes by so quickly.
Yeah.
But I'm also singing. Danny Kaye was in a show called Lady in the Dark, which, as they say, he became a star overnight. And he sang, I guess it's about 39 names of Russian composers in so many seconds, called Tchaikovsky, with music by Kurt Weill. And the words were by Ira Gershwin. Excuse me. So, and then there's a song that I'm doing from Chicago, Mr. Cellophane, which is about this, if people remember the movie, Amos, I think, was the name of Roxy Hart's husband, and he just had an inferiority complex. So I'm doing songs like that, which I enjoy performing.
All right. And now, I have a question about coming into Juneau with your act and finding a local pianist, Rob Cohn, and getting it together in a really short period of time. What is this, intense rehearsal a couple of times? And maybe, did you guys get together before you came and talk this over at all?
No.
So you met him here?
Yes.
Okay.
I met him
about...
You
knew he was going to... No.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Dove said that Rob can play anything.
Okay.
Now, I've been in situations where I've been told, oh, so-and-so can play anything, and they can't. They can't. And this Danny Kaye music...
Yeah, finding that out the evening before a performance could be a little bit hairy.
Very, yes. Very scary.
Yeah.
But I sent him some recordings of what I was doing, and he diligently listened to the recordings, because as he said, when Sylvia Fine wrote this music, the music is written with setups for punchlines that may exist.
Yeah.
The music has false starts, if you will. It goes slow, and then it goes into a fast waltz, and then it goes slow with a little recitative, and then it goes into other things as well. Excuse me, Rob and I met maybe, we rehearsed today for 2 hours.
Huh.
And now we're doing the show.
And you're comfortable.
No, I never said that. This, you know, it's not easy material, but he said that he...
He's planning on staying up all night.
Yeah, but I think he stayed up all night already.
Oh, okay.
Learning this music and the recordings that I sent him. So
beautiful.
But, you know, comedy is where you're supposed to have fun.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, if I just tell people this is like a party, and if I make mistakes and he makes mistakes, we're all friends here. This is really raising money for a fantastic cause, NAMI, and I'm thrilled to be here to make more people in Juneau aware of the wonderful work that this organization, this association, does, and to come out, and hopefully there will be some people out there who are scratching their heads saying, well, I don't know what this organization is, but I'm coming to have a good time, and they'll learn about all the wonderful things that it does.
We should tell everyone that this event is going to occur where?
At the Jack.
Okay, and it's 4 to 6 in the afternoon on Sunday.
Sunday afternoon.
$20
for tickets. You can come at the door, although we do recommend you get them at the Hearthside Books or at the Jack, or you can go online at namijuno.org.
Now, Dove, you mentioned that the fundraiser is going to go primarily to train some people to be peer counselors or peer...
Well, what NAMI does, we're a grassroots organization, and we provide support groups and courses which are done all over the country, but to teach or facilitate them, you need to be trained by in a certified manner, and it's a... Again, it's a volunteer, but everyone who leads our programs is someone who is a caregiver for a loved one with mental illness or themselves is in recovery from mental illness. Mm-hmm. So the funds, we put these funds so we can send people to trainings and they can come back and really do great things for the community.
That's really an outstanding ongoing program, yeah.
Thank you.
And in the past, you've funded this from other sources, but
well, we do receive the bulk of our funds from the Mental Health Trust, Alaska Mental Health Trust. But we've been asked, and it's a fair thing to ask, is they want us to diversify and strengthen our funding sources, and so we've wanted to for some time now to go in the community to let them know what we're doing, also to ask people to support what we're doing.
And the obvious direction to go if you're going to diversify raising money for a mental health would be into musical comedy. The relationship
absolutely.
Is absolutely clear in my mind. But
well, humor is, we say at all our workshops that humor is a very important piece of self-care and
well, the times I've been really ill, which was only, thank God, only once in my life, it was humor that brought me through. I'll tell you that.
Yes,
absolutely.
It is.
So a belly laugh is worth 60,000 aspirin, I think, or something like that.
What do they say? Humor is the best medicine.
It's amazing stuff, isn't it?
It is.
And you must be incredibly healthy because I think you laugh a lot. His name is Don Kroll, folks. He's going to be showing Sunday afternoon, 4 to 6 p.m. at the Jack. Welcome to Juneau. Glad we could get you a little Juneau rain so you wouldn't go away thinking it's sunny here all the time.
Thank you.
And we'll be looking forward to hearing you and singing with you, maybe.
We look forward to seeing people. We'll see you there. Come and enjoy.
This is Bird Note. The musical, wren-like song you just heard is that of a lesser yellowlegs, a type of sandpiper. We know lesser yellowlegs and other sandpipers for their busy foraging on mudflats and at the ocean's edge, but perhaps not for their singing. Now, picture this bird in its nesting territory in Alaska, sitting atop a spruce tree. That's right, a sandpiper perched at the top of a tree like our backyard robins, singing its caroling song. The name sandpiper actually comes from the birds' voices rather than from their long billed probing in the sand, while the name refers in particular to the birds' short-piped or whistled calls. A number of sandpipers are also superior and surprising singers. Listen to this dunlin as it sings in flight over its nesting territory in the Alaskan tundra. And this eerie hooting, which might conjure up the image of an owl at night, is actually the song of a pectoral sandpiper. Singing on the tundra well north of the Arctic Circle. You can hear these sandpipers again and see photos when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Well, I think you should always bring in a famous musician by his music, and I just did that with Zul Bailey, who's on the telephone with us from Sitka. Hi, Zul.
Hi, and you know, sometimes it's a problem hearing your own music because you overanalyze, but thank you for that.
I have trouble always remembering how to pronounce his name. Is it Abadigan?
Awadajan.
Awadajan Prat was the pianist, and of course that was Zul Bailey with cello. And after listening to the entire works of Bach last year, I think we recognize your cello almost without thinking about it.
You know? Oh, that's very kind. I, you know, one time I was, one of the only times that I actually enjoyed my own playing was I was driving down the street and I heard a cello on the radio. This was in Washington, D.C., and the cello sound just made me very comfortable. And I don't know, it was like a very familiar voice speaking to me in a way that I understood. And then after about 3 minutes, I realized...
That it was you.
Oh, no. This is me. And I started kind of freaking out, and I had to turn the channel immediately.
Well, that guy is really good.
Well, I thought so until I realized it was me, and then it wasn't. So.
And then you realized that you had to take it apart and analyze it. You got to stop doing that. You are an amazing musician. You know.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, we got to talk about you've taken over the Sitka Summer Music Festival in a big way, and you really have a terrific program coming up. Starting tomorrow.
This is a really terrific season, summer. It was an amazing transition when Paul Rosenthal, the founder and artistic director for 40 years, asked me if I would continue to carry this torch and to take it for the next 40 years. He asked me with so much time to really get to know Alaska, Sitka, Juneau, Fairbanks, the entire state for this transition. He actually asked me in 2008. The transition happened like 3 years later. So for 3 years, I was able to audit and follow around and shadow him, get to know people, get to know what the state could handle and in what pace, what he had done. And so for his 40th anniversary, he very graciously asked me to be a part of the programming, to incorporate all of the superstars that he invited over the past 40 years, and also to implant some of my new ideas, which was a cafe series and a film series, and to rename the brown bag lunches, the box lunch series, and put it in Centennial Hall here and make it kind of more official. So long story short, all of those things have evolved beautifully and naturally over the past 3 years. This will be my third summer solely being the artistic director, and I get to, in this case, invite back already familiar favorites from my tenure in addition to Paul's tenure, which include himself and Evan Drachman and Marcus Thompson and other Alaska favorites, including Edward Zilberkant and things like that. So to say I'm excited is quite an understatement.
Now, I have to say that anyone who would name a lunchtime concert box lunch deserves at least some approbation. You need it. We'll have a room for apologies at the end of the program. Okay.
Well, it's better than naming a concert sex. It's better than naming a concert Sextets in the City.
Yeah. Okay. I suppose that'll work. Thank God you didn't do that too.
Never say never.
Okay, so I'm looking at the program here. It was lovely that it was published in the arts section of the Juneau paper this time. I'm not sure I remember that happening every year in the past. So you start off with wine and music with friends,
right.
And then each week you're having a cafe concert, which is a free concert like the ones that we hold for our jazz and classics in various places around town. And then you also have the box lunch. I wince, but the box lunch. Which is another free concert also that music goes on. And then you have evening concerts. Those are, of course, pay tickets. But there's one of those. There are two of those every weekend. Is that
right?
Yeah.
Well, the method to my madness is that the cafe concerts are a way to get to know the musicians in a very, very comfortable, casual setting,
yeah,
where people give kind of a smorgasbord or kind of a tapas menu of pieces that they're important to them that they may or may not hear throughout the week, backstories, all these different things. And also then the audiences get to hang out with the musicians. So when they walk into the concerts later in the week, it's very personally and artistically driven. The box lunch is a nice way to do a midday concert where people can bring their families, where there's not a problem with the evening concerts running too late, and as well as the fact that the cruise ships that dock here, it is, of course, sponsored by Alaska Cruises, can also take advantage of the artist because they're usually back on the ship by the evening. So then when we get to Friday and we have our what I would maybe label the Masterworks series, then we have the kind of the bigger evening events that then will draw into, you know, a nice gathering afterwards. But those are the events that are the repertoire that I wouldn't necessarily program in those other kinds of settings. So between all of those platforms, we're able to, as an audience and a community, enjoy all different kinds of music and also the personalities of the performers themselves.
There's another element that I notice in the program that you've incorporated, which I think is very admirable, and that is you're introducing each of the concerts with a 30-minute pre-concert conversation with Susan Wingrove Reed.
That's right. And this is actually what, you know, I don't like. Well, this is my opinion, but I don't like to be lectured. I like to be, you know, I like a great discussion and what's really behind why people spend this kind of music, this kind of time exploring the music and as musicians, et cetera, and also why these composers wrote these things. So Susan has been a gift that she gets up there on the stage right before the concert and essentially interviews, has a conversation with the artists. She will give insight into the music itself, but then she will go into what the artists, why this is their lifeblood of the moment, why they have spent so much time preparing this music. And so we get to, again, before the notes start, we get to find out the importance of why we should care, other than the fact that it's just great music.
Zuhl, this is a Sitka-based concert series. It runs all the way from May 31st until June 29th. Are there any special arrangements for transportation to and from Sitka during the concert period?
To and from Sitka, what, to other places?
No, for folks from outside of Sitka who can't just walk down the block to get to this fabulous music.
Well, this was of course one of the hopes we have is that the people would take long weekends and come here and spend a little bit of time here during the summer. This is a very interesting parallel adventure that we have here. This festival was formed 40 years ago to get the greatest musicians on earth to come to the greatest place on earth, being Alaska, and to actually make the most beautiful music on earth, not only for themselves, but in a setting that would inspire the people around them and also bring people from around the world to Sitka. One thing that we've evolved into doing, which has been, primarily driven by Paul in the 80s, is that he began after the summer touring musicians and taking them to Juneau and Fairbanks and Barrow and Nome and Ketchikan and all over the state to then take the music to the people, not only through these concerts that maybe were born in Sitka during the summer, but through in something that I'm going to take further, through, you know, infiltrating a village or a community and also providing them with musical education and background on the arts that they may or may not have on a consistent basis in their community already. So, yes, of course, to answer your question, people would have to take the ferry here if they came from Juneau or other places like that, or they'd have to fly in for the week. And that's wonderful, and that's happening a lot. Obviously, the cruise ships bring thousands of people here from all over the world, and that's also wonderful. But our mission is not just to provide entertainment locally here, but is to kind of become, and we are, the premier classical performing arts association in all of Alaska, bringing classical music to the whole state.
So it says in my story here that I'm reading that you can buy a season ticket or you can purchase tickets for each event listed. Is there anything like a week ticket? Could you purchase, for instance, if you were coming down to Sitka to stay for a week, could you purchase any kind of discount on all of the concerts in that
way? You know what? I'm sure that there are, and I don't want to speak out of turn here, but
okay.
Kayla Betcher, our executive director, would field any of those phone calls and probably give a special discount if people were to come for the week and buy the package for that very week. In particular, Juneau, there is a fast ferry that runs Thursday,
yes.
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, which is a terrific weekend getaway. And I've taken that as well, and it's very relaxing, of course.
And it only takes about 3.5 hours to get down there. So
yeah, it's one of the great things that one.
I didn't mean to stick you on the spot there about the ticket. It's just something that occurred to me while we were talking.
Well, it's a terrific idea, and I believe that's already in motion because people do come for the long weekend, and they do want to purchase all of the events and go to the special activities. You know, the first weekend here, the wine and cheese event is actually a kickoff featuring Paul Rosenthal. And Arnulf, his pianist, is here, and it's going to be a terrific way to celebrate him, and also to kind of course, give insight into the entire month of activities. What you haven't mentioned, though, is that we've added 2 weeks after this festival of the inaugural Sitka Cello Seminar. And so cellists from all over the world, students, young artists, rising stars, are flying in to study. And this is why we are so proud of having Stevenson Hall be our institution now, our home base, what I kind of jokingly call the mother ship, that now we get to have a residency that we will build throughout the entire year to showcase and give artists a retreat for educational as well as individual study.
So this is an amazing musical event that goes on every year. It sounds like under your capable hands, it's grown into something even more. By the way, we should quickly mention that you are showing films as well.
Yes, the film series, and they're all musically based films. Whether it be the soundtrack was written by one of the composers that we're featuring that week, or the thematic material in the film features maybe the life of the composer, in essence, like Chopin or Mozart or Beethoven or these kinds of things. Or in the case of a couple of our performers over the years, they are actually in the movie, so people get to see these people that they see playing their instruments in a Hollywood movie, which is also really terrific. But that's a kind of a glorified outreach in a fun way, because I don't think people see these films as being a way to get to know even deeper and in interesting ways this classical music, and of course it is.
Great opportunities. The Sitka Summer Music Festival starts in Sitka on May 31st with Wine and Music with Friends, ends on June 29th, but is followed by a cello seminar that will last for, did you say, 2 weeks?
That's right.
Right.
Yep.
Zul, thank you so much for filling us in on what's going on.
Thank you for your time, and appreciate all of it, everything. Thank you.
Good talking to you again.
Okay, take care.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 30th of May, 2014. The Lincoln Memorial was dedicated on this day in 1922. The architect Henry Bacon designed it to resemble the Parthenon. It has the Gettysburg Address on one wall, and on the other, the second inaugural address of Lincoln. There is a myth that the profile of Robert E. Lee appears in the locks of Lincoln's hair. The National Park Service says that is not true. It is true, however, that at the dedication in 1922, the audience was segregated, and the keynote speaker, Robert Moton, president of the Tuskegee Institute, an African American, was not allowed to sit on the speaker's platform. It was on this day, 1849, Henry David Thoreau published his own book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, an account of a 2-week boating trip that he'd taken with his brother John from Massachusetts to New Hampshire and back. Henry had been the introverted one. John was more gregarious. The two brothers were very close, and a few years after their boat trip, John contracted tetanus and died in his brother's arms. It was after that Henry decided to go into seclusion, build a cabin by the banks of Walden Pond, lived there for 2 years, and in those 2 years he finished the draft of The Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, and he also wrote a series of lectures that would eventually become his classic Walden. The book A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers did not sell well, and the publisher delivered all the unsold copies to Thoreau's home in Concord. Thoreau wrote, "I have now a library of nearly 900 volumes, over 700 of which I wrote myself." And it was on this day in 1431 that Joan of Arc was burned at the stake for heresy in Rouen, France. She was 19 years old. She had led the French army at the Battle of Orléans, defeating the English, eventually was captured by enemy soldiers. She was interrogated endlessly, spent her time in prison chained to a wooden block. She was told that if she didn't sign a confession, she would be put to death, and she signed it. A few days later, she renounced the confession, and on this day in 1431, she was burned at the stake. She was mostly forgotten for about 400 years, and then revived as a great national heroine during the French Revolution. She became the only person ever burned at the stake for heresy, who later became a saint. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston, The Months. March, when the Earl King came to steal away the child in Goethe's poem, the father said, "Don't be afraid, it's just the wind," as if it weren't the wind that blows away the tender fragments of this world. Leftover leaves in the corners of the garden, a Lenten rose that thought it safe to bloom so early. April, in the pastel blur of the garden, the cherry and redbud shake rain from their delicate shoulders as petals of pink dogwood wash down the ditches in dreamlike rivers of color. May, mayapple, daffodil, hyacinth, lily, and by the front porch steps, every billowing shade of purple and lavender lilac, my mother's favorite flower, sweet breath, drifting through the open windows, perfume of memory, conduit of spring. The Months, a poem by Linda Paston from The Last Uncle, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
So this distinctive music that you're hearing in the background is the new theme song for a new feature here that will be airing on Juno Afternoon periodically throughout the rest of the summer and maybe into the future after that. This is called Fish 101, and what we're doing with this is each time we have this little 15-minute segment, we are going to be exploring another aspect of fishing around Juno, fish around Juno, and the commercial fishing enterprise. Today, our guest is the aquarium manager and education coordinator for DIPAC, the red-roofed hatchery building that's alongside the road that everyone wonders exactly what goes on in. So let's find out. Here is Rich Mattson to join us. Hi, Rich.
Hey there.
So tell us a little bit about what a hatchery does.
Well, actually, a hatchery produces salmon, at least DIPAC and the hatcheries here in Alaska. It's sort of an agricultural model where we call it an ocean ranching format, and it's sort of the format that's used by West Coast hatcheries up and down the coast for producing salmon and other species of salmonids. But basically, we're putting out fish, we're taking eggs, rearing them, husbanding them through the early life stage in freshwater, and then releasing them into the ocean. So in a ranching, and we call it ocean ranching because in the ranching analogy, the hatchery facility is like a ranch to take care of the young ones. Then we let them out in the ocean pasture. And at that point, they instinctively follow their natural migratory instincts to go out into the North Pacific to the ocean pasture, where they migrate, roam, feed, and at maturity respond to nature's call to return back to the point they came from. And then along the way, they're subject to harvest by not only natural predators, which take away many of the fish early on, but as they come into Southeast in particular, for our operations, then they're harvested by all the fisheries along the way, from commercial fisheries out in the Gulf with trawlers on in through the Inside Passage and back to the release points. And the basic idea is just simply not to replace nature, but to provide a added sustainable increase to natural production, because salmon historically and naturally follow cycles of abundance and decline. In fact, that's really where DIPAC started, is that in the early 1970s, statewide Alaska salmon production, natural salmon production, which is all that was going on at the time, was at a low ebb. In fact, I've got an old book that put out by the old Alaska Geographic Society called The Silver Years, and it was written, I think it was 75, and it was just like sort of signing off on the fisheries. It was history, and now it's gone, because, again, in 74, it was one of the lowest catches ever. By that time, however, the fishermen and the managers were desperate to try to sort of jumpstart the resource again, and taking a page from what had been going on down south with hatcheries, particularly agency hatcheries in the states and federal government, trying to learn from some of the mistakes of the past. First of all, the state started a system of hatcheries, and then the fishermen themselves as stakeholders wanted to have an active role. And in 1974, the state legislature enacted the historic Private Nonprofit Act, which allowed private operators representing either fishermen or regional associations of all gear groups, primarily commercial fisheries, to participate as well. And that's actually when DIPAC got started. So getting back to your question of what a hatchery is, it's a way to increase the production, and it starts, it's rooted, our modern era of hatcheries is rooted in the low natural production of the 1970s.
Rich, how does a hatchery differ from a fish farm?
A fish farm, which is sort of the model that's in place in other temperate latitude countries such as Norway, Canada, Japan, New Zealand, there the fish are contained all of their life in artificial man-made environments, receiving artificial diets with natural ingredients for the most part. But they're there from death till harvest period, whereas a sea ranch or an ocean ranch, such as we operate and it's the model here in Alaska, the fish are free roaming. They're virtually considered to be wild fish from the time we release them. They're eating natural food, following their instinctive behaviors, and when they come back, they've gained, you know, many-fold weight gain, and in all effect, they're natural fish.
Rich, how long does a salmon stay in the open ocean? How long is its lifetime out there?
Well, actually, there's five species of Pacific salmon on the eastern Pacific, and that's the pink, chum, king, coho, and sockeye. And each one actually has rather distinctive differences in their life cycle. But when it comes to the ocean phase, it can be anywhere from several months, but typically more along from 1 year. Pink salmon are like the smallest and youngest fish when they return at maturity. They have a strict two-year cycle. Incubation in the stream or hatchery environment until the following spring when they emerge from the substrate or gravel and go out to the ocean. So it's about a year for them. Our stock of coho that we use for DIPAC operations, it's more along about 18 months in the hatchery, 18 months in the ocean, about half and half. And the other three species, king coho and chum, have what we call multiple age class returns. They can be anywhere from 2 years to 3 or 4 years in the ocean.
Is the death of a salmon, the salmon are killed in the process of extracting the eggs. Is that correct, or they die shortly?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what, first of all, is there anything to relieve the pain of whatever that is, or if there is any? Or?
Well, you have to remember what the salmon's life cycle is to begin with. Salmon are what we call anadromous species of fish. They start life in freshwater, go to the ocean, and return back. And after they spawn, they die. When they go into the freshwater environment, they stop feeding, and their body internally breaks down to release the energy they've gained from the ocean to give them the energy they need to ascend to the stream to their origin and to complete the spawning act. And then basically they're worn out, and they just die away anywhere from a few hours to a week before they finally expire. In our operation, we simply put them to sleep. The fish ascend our fish ladder, which is their home stream at the McCulley Hatchery facility. They are guided up concrete raceways. There's no gravel for them to spawn in, so they keep swimming upstream, and they end up in a big black box. There's a cage they swim into, and at that point the operator presses a button. They receive a charge of direct current electricity. That stuns the fish. They're not outright killed, but they're stunned, so they're immobile, and they're quickly lifted up, and in that process, they die of, in a few moments of suffocation. They can't breathe, no gill movement, so it's all over with.
So then the eggs are extracted. Now, what happens to the fish then?
Now we've got that fish is used economically. Our primary returners are chum runner. We have several hundred thousand adults return every year now, about which 100,000 or so are used for brood stock that we take the eggs from. And then surplus fish that come back on top of that, we also extract eggs for commercial egg production. But in any case, the fish end up in fish totes, and we have contracts with the local fish processors that take the fish down to their plants. They've developed markets now for the last 4 or 5 years in Asian countries and Eastern Europe, as I understand. So at that point, it's another fish just like they'd get from a tender on the grounds. And there's nothing wrong with the meat unless the fish itself is damaged or diseased. And those, of course, are all culled out and, you know, usually frozen for bait, I imagine. But for the fish themselves, the meat's just simply softer because they've extracted the fat and oil in the maturation process, and but it's good protein. And other countries recognize that, and so we have economic markets for them.
About this time of year around the area, we see these floats out in various places where streams come into the ocean. That's part of your process, right?
It sounds like you're talking about our remote rearing sites. That's
yes.
Correct. Much of our production is actually put out or released from other pen rearing sites in the area, both on the road system and in remote locations. And each site is put in place under a management plan that we operate under that's overseen by the Fish and Game Department. So when the fish are released from these different sites, they actually imprint and learn the receiving water from that site, whether it be a nearby stream or just simply that unique chemical signature for that area. They have extremely keen sense of smell in terms of parts per billion or better, and they home back after they follow their natural migratory instincts to that site, and then they're available for fisheries harvest by either commercial fisheries or private or sport and personal use.
So I guess final question. We started this process with fish hatcheries because basically the fish had been fished out.
It wasn't so much they were fished out. It was actually climatic conditions that had provided, sort of, not provided, but there were years of very cold winters, both in the freshwater environment and the ocean environment. And years later, the scientists found out there was a sort of a long-term climatic condition called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which sort of like a teeter-totter in the Pacific Northwest. In the 70s, returns were at all-time highs for their hatchery production and natural production. And in Alaska, it was on the other end of the teeter-totter at low production. And that was when, unbeknownst to the people, I mean, that phenomenon wasn't really discovered or determined until later, but that's when the fisheries really wanted to try to jumpstart the resource and get it going again.
So the question is, did it work?
It certainly has. I'm very proud of being part of DIPAC. We're a major producer of salmon in this region, and our returns have been very substantial, particularly in the last, since 2006, we started getting some really big returns, and it hasn't slowed down since. And it's been benefiting all fisheries users and our whole regional economy.
Outstanding. Rich Mattson, who is the aquarium manager and education coordinator for DIPAC, the Douglas Island Pink and Chum Hatchery here in Juneau. Thank you so much for helping us kick off Fish 101.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Play spawn till you die if you're doing a talk on salmon, don't you now? That's the Ratfish Wranglers out of Ketchikan, with Ray Troll, of course, on the microphone singing one of their famous hits from their album, which is entitled The Ratfish Wranglers. So there you go, where the fish are. Anyway, my next guests are here to tell us about competition, and I'm really curious about that phrase. So joining me here are Laura Haywood and Abe Levy, and you're going to be one of the competitors, right?
No, I'm going to be one of the judges.
One of the judges. Ah, okay. So you get to sit up there and take notes and then decide. So this is Wednesday, June 4th. It's at 7 o'clock at the Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium, and this is the Juno Symphony Youth Solo Competition.
Correct.
So is this to seat new members of the symphony?
No. These are young people, and this is a competition. And the winner, there may be up to two winners. One will play a concerto with the regular symphony next year, and one will play one with the student symphony. So the prize is a performance. And Abe can tell you about this because he won this when he was in high school.
Wonderful.
Playing the piano.
Yeah, this is about 10 years ago now. I played the first movement of the Grieg Piano Concerto in A minor. And it's a really, really great opportunity for the youth to get out there and, for one, perform as a soloist, which there's not a lot of opportunities for generally, and then to be able to perform as a soloist with a full orchestra is something that very few people get to do without going on to study music at a higher collegiate level and beyond. So it's a really great opportunity for these.
Well, our youth symphony is a wonderful institution here in Juneau. It's provided many people a wonderful opportunity. We should mention here, by the way, that the term youth symphony is considered extremely relative.
And we don't use it. We call that, the symphony itself is called the student symphony for
Students,
that reason.
Okay, yeah.
There's all kinds of gray hair in the student symphony.
Yes. I know it well. And and all kinds of great music in the student symphony.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So who else is going to be in the competition?
Okay, I can read you the list.
Yeah.
Catlin Barrows, Reese Bleakley, James Cheng, Henry Cheng, Meredith Fritch, Olivia Gardner, Taza Haddock, Dugan McNutt, Robert Newman, Jaden West, and Alexander Yu.
Ah, so these are names that a lot of people are going to recognize.
Sure.
Since these folks are very active in the music scene around.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of my questions, these are not all playing the same instrument or anything like that. Are you judging just piano, or will you judge other?
No, there's a panel of three judges, and we'll judge all of the instruments together, and then together we'll make a decision as to who wins the grand prize and who wins the other prize. There'll be one grand prize who performs with the Juno Symphony, and then the other will perform with the Student Symphony, although we can alter that if we...
Well, Abe, without requiring that I get a 3-year degree in musicology, give me an idea of what the criteria that you look for are.
We're looking for, of course, technical ability, musicality, stage presence, a variety of those types of things. It has to be a piece, of course, that will play well with the symphony, and then something that the musician, you can tell that they love, is generally something that will come across for the winners.
And if we get two winners, then how does this work? Will there be two separate concerts?
There are two divisions.
Okay.
So there's a junior division, and if there is a grand prize winner in that, that person will play with the Student Symphony. And then there's a senior division. There's actually, I think, only three people in the senior division. Most of them are juniors this year. It varies. So then that grand prize winner would play with the Juno Symphony.
Ah, okay.
So
this is free and open to the public.
Yes.
And you're holding it at Thunder Mountain High School in the big auditorium up there.
Correct.
So anyone who wants to hear these students and listen to their competitive pieces can certainly do that.
It's at 7 p.m., and I really encourage people to come and support these young musicians. And there will be a reception afterwards. Actually, the judges, the students will finish playing, and then the judges will confer, and they will actually Kyle Pickett will make the announcement afterward at that reception. So you can stick around and find out who won.
Oh, and we have a wonderful concert coming up in to honor Kyle Pickett, I think, very shortly here.
Well, it's his last concert of the season, and it's identical to the very first program that he did 14 years ago. So
I didn't know that. That's excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then our new conductor is coming in. I think his first concert is...
Actually, we're still in the selection process.
Okay, so that's right. We have a series of 3 years,
I think.
We have
three candidates, right.
Okay, yeah.
So the first one of those will be in the fall. And, in fact, we're going to, I believe, announce the actual schedule at that last Kyle concert, which is June 14th and 15th.
Okay.
And as long as I'm plugging things, we also have a Farewell to Kyle fundraising dinner, which is next weekend, at Glacier Gardens. It's going to be wonderful.
I had heard about that.
Yeah, and you can look on Vendini, or you can go to the Arts Council and get tickets, or you can call our office.
Right.
And
Abe, are you performing right now?
Yes, I'm the principal bassist with the Juno Symphony, so I've been playing on the last few concerts, and we'll be playing up again on this current set that we're rehearsing for right now.
Wonderful. Is this the beginnings of a musical career, or the middle part of a musical career?
It's, of course, the volunteer orchestra, but it's something that I love to do, and so I...
Do you have aspirations?
No, I like playing with the symphony. I do a little bit of solo work on the piano as well, but it's I guess, a casual interest.
Is it possible to have a casual interest in music?
Well, I think that's the wonderful thing about Juno, is there's so many really brilliant, brilliant, talented musicians that have day jobs but love this town because they get to play.
And that is one of the wonders of Juno, is that you get to play.
Yeah.
It's one of the treasures of my life that I have occasionally gotten on stage, and it's a heck of a lot of fun. And your friends and neighbors are out there in the audience and cheering and applauding you. Thank you so much. The Juno Symphony Youth Solo Competition, Wednesday, June 4th, 7 p.m., Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium, free and open to the public. Come and support this wonderful group of young musicians who are going to be competing for the opportunity to play with a symphony orchestra. Yeah, cool.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering coffee break service for the office, delivering fresh roasted coffees, brewing equipment, and beverage supplies to offices and businesses around Southeast. Information at heritagecoffee.com.
Hi, this is Cheryl Snyder. I'd like to invite you to either renew or start your membership in K2 today. It's very easy to do. Just go to ktoo.org and click on the Contribute button. Remember, K2 is a nonprofit organization that receives the largest portion of its funding from you. You who listens and loves having such incredible public media in Juneau. If you've never given before or your last gift to the station was a year ago, join the 3,500 other listeners who have already given this year at ktoo.org.
You can look fine and feel fine and still have health issues that need attention. Conditions like high blood pressure, prediabetes, and some cancers are easier to treat when they are found early. Getting a yearly checkup is the first step. Make an appointment today and make a yearly checkup a part of your routine. Take charge of your health. Take charge of your life. For more information, go to safeandhealthyme.alaska.gov. This message is brought to you by the State of Alaska, Department of Health and Social Services.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Spicer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org, and support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Tune in on Monday when Joan Pardis hosts. She'll have details about Perseverance Theater's Summerfest. Daryl Bowers will come in to highlight the IDEA homeschool program. Time now for All Things Considered.